Welcome to today's Innovative Ideas podcast. Our guest this afternoon is renowned legal expert Richard A. Epstein, visiting scholar at the Manhattan Institute. Professor Epstein is also the Lawrence A. Tisch Professor at New York University Law School, as well as the Peter and Kirsten Bedford Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution. He is also the James Parker Hall Distinguished Service Professor of Law at the University of Chicago. Professor Epstein is one of the nation's most prolific legal thinkers, with writing spanning a broad array of fields, including the common law subjects of property, contracts, and torts. He is also one of the three most cited law professors in the United States. Professor Epstein joins us today to discuss his analysis of the recent Virginia District Court decision in Virginia v. Sebelius, striking down the federal mandate that individuals must buy health insurance contained in the Affordable Care Act. Richard, thank you for joining us today.
Oh, it's my great pleasure.
Richard, reading Judge Hutchins' decision today and then your commentary on it on ricochet.com, I was struck that this was a very carefully tailored decision that seemed to aim at the tiny crack left in Supreme Court jurisprudence on the Commerce Clause, namely whether or not Congress can require individual activity in furtherance of its regulation of interstate commerce. Could you summarize briefly how we've gotten to this point and where that tiny crack is left?
I can certainly summarize briefly is a different question. The way in which the Commerce Clause began, you have to go back to a case called Gibbons and Ogden in 1824. And the challenge in that particular case was to try to figure out what the meaning was of the phrase, Congress shall have the power to regulate commerce with foreign nations among the several states and with the Indian tribes. And Chief Justice Marshall thought he was giving a bold and expansive interpretation when he said that it covered navigation from the point of departure to the point of arrival, so long as the trip crossed state lines. And essentially, these interstate transactions, cross-border transactions, would give the federal government the power to regulate things like the railroads and telecommunications across states. But anything like healthcare or manufacture or agriculture, which took place as a productive activity within the state, would be outside the scope of the federal government. And this was a stable interpretation of the Constitution up until the New Deal. At that point, there was a huge sea change, in which it was held that activities that once had been regarded as either preparatory to or subsequent to interstate commerce now became part of interstate commerce because it had a substantial effect on what went on in interstate commerce. So the two major cases that sort of defined the New Deal era were the National Labor Relations case, a case called Jones and Laughlin against the NLRB, where the Supreme Court decided that it could organize collective bargaining within any given manufacturing plant, even though the plant itself was not in interstate commerce, so long as the goods that it sold went into interstate commerce. And then it decided 5 years later in a case called Wickard and Thilburn in 1942 that it could regulate the amount of grain that was grown on anybody's land, even if it was fed to his own cows, because the amount that was created and consumed on the land would influence, as indeed was the case, the amount of grain that would go into interstate commerce. So already there's a kind of a surreal attitude with respect to the Commerce Clause insofar as it takes local activities and subjects them to federal power, even though no interstate transaction is actually involved. Now, for many years, people thought that this meant that there was basically no limitation on what Congress could do in regulating economic activities. But in the last, say, 15 or 20 years, there's been a little bit of pushback on this. I take some mischievous credit for having started some of this stuff in 1987, when I wrote an article called The Proper Scope of the Commerce Clause, defending on functional as well as historical grounds the pre-1937 understanding, which limited the government to organizing interstate transactions. That bore a little bit of fruit in two cases. One of them was called Lopez and the other was called Morrison, one dealing in effect with holding guns with or possessing guns within 100 yards or 1,000 feet of a school, and the second having to do with the question of whether or not a dormitory rape would influence interstate commerce, and the answer to both those questions that the Supreme Court gave was no. But there it seemed to stop. In a case called Reich against Gonzalez, what the Supreme Court held was that if you grow marijuana in your own backyard and then use it for your own medical purposes, you're engaged in interstate commerce. With these surreal cases on the books, everybody thought that when it came to the Health Care Act, if you could regulate homegrown marijuana, why, regulating an entire healthcare system has to be within interstate commerce. And it's at this point a man named Randy Barnett, who's a professor of law at Georgetown University, basically started a one-man band. And he said, no, if you look at this, the Commerce Clause has as its predicate that there be some economic activity that somebody undertake, even if it's as inconsequential as growing marijuana in your own backyard. And when you look at the individual mandate, it flunks that test. What you're doing here is you're telling an individual who's done nothing at all that you are now duty-bound, as it were, to get yourself into interstate commerce by buying a policy in order to protect you against the various vicissitudes of health care, even when you know that most of the money you spend is not going to be spent to take care of you, but to take care of other people because of the cross-subsidies implicit in the entire health care bill. And so, in a kind of ironic twist, it's not a small hole. It's actually a fairly big exception. If this line between doing and not doing, misfeasance and nonfeasance, holds, then it turns out that the United States cannot dragoon anybody into a series of involuntary transactions in which they wish not to participate. What the United States can do is it can tell you, if you want to drive a car, you have to buy insurance, you have to contribute to an assigned risk pool, but we can't make you drive a car so that we could force you to buy insurance and force you to go into an assigned risk pool. So that's the position that he took, and the government has had a devilish time trying to explain why it is that that position is wrong. And I must say I've heard Randy argue this on multiple occasions, and I've never heard a really powerful rejoinder. What people want to say is that, look, we've never had this problem before, to which his answer is, and it would be mine as well, if it's unprecedented, it doesn't mean that it's lawful, it means that it's truly contestable, and you have to decide one way or another as to whether you're going to regulate it or not. And then what people do is they come up with a free rider argument and say, well, we have to force these people into the system in order to make the budgets balance. But this is free riders in a way that no economist understands the term. The standard free rider is the fellow who's trying to get something for nothing by passively sitting by while other people provide a public good. In this particular case, these guys are free riders only to the extent that they don't wish to pay subsidies to other individuals. And you could avoid the free rider problem by eliminating the subsidy. Whereas in other cases, you have to avoid the free rider problem by eliminating national defense, the court system, the traffic system, and everything else. So what's happened is the free rider argument, which became the government's major piece, looks to be very suspect as an economic matter. And when the judge listened to the arguments, as he did fairly carefully, I think even he had a growing sense of astonishment that this misfeasance, nonfeasance line was a lot more durable than any line that the government could compose. So, for example, under the government's test, it's perfectly okay for the state to pass a statute which says everybody has to have a bowl of oatmeal every day, whether they like it or not, because that's going to reduce health care costs by making people healthier. So what happens is a very strong anti-authoritarian stream of thought gets tied in with a jurisdictional provision called the Commerce Clause. At the same time, when people try to make it as a straight liberty argument on substantive due process grounds, for example, it gets thrown out of court. As Alice said in Wonderland, this is curiouser and curiouser. But as I wrote on that Ricochet blob some time ago, I think this argument actually has legs. And there are many people who think it may come down to one vote, that is to our good friend Anthony Kennedy, who decides when he throws a coin up in the air whether it will come down heads in favor of the traditional view or tails in favor of this newly crafted theory, which seems to have a lot more intellectual integrity than many of us, myself included, believed it when it started. So anyhow, that's where it starts.
Well, that may not be brief, but it is an excellent summary of how we've gotten to the point where we've gotten to. And to maybe go off on a tiny little side tangent here, the government's argument about why they need to get everyone to the risk pool is, in a sense, created by another regulatory problem they've created through something called EMTALA, where if the argument is, well, there are people who wait to get health care until they're sick or they go to hospital emergency rooms and get care there, the problem is you've made it impossible for people to charge for doing that activity.
I mean, EMTALA is a statute which is the emergency, and I keep forgetting, it has to do with child with traumatic injury and active labor is what the statute is about. And back in the 1980s, in the Reagan administration, essentially what they did is they told hospitals that they were duty-bound to take people in, but they were not able to charge them if they did not have money. And the statute has been extremely problematic in its application. The biggest objection to it is it actually reduces the amount of care that is available because many major institutions have either closed down their emergency rooms, shrunk them in size, refused to join various kinds of ambulance networks that bring people to them because they simply cannot afford the cost of trying to run this system. It has also provoked hospitals to enter into elaborate sharing arrangements such that those hospitals which are on the, say, the edge of town near a very bad neighborhood and get all the gunshot wounds on Saturday night get some kind of a subsidy, a subvention from other hospitals in nice, rich suburban areas who take nobody on at all. And this should be a warning with respect to Obamacare, in the sense that what EMTALA shows is that the system of cross-subsidies, in many cases, works much less than a system of voluntarism, in which hospitals set up an emergency room and have, as they did in the 19th century, the complete discretion to take somebody in or to let them die. Most of the time, you don't let people die. If you're running a hospital, that's not generally what you're in business to. But keeping the right essentially allows you to constrain the way in which the processes work. And you don't get into these dreadful situations where some person comes in dreadful condition, you could spend a fortune with very little chances of help, and so tie up all your resources that you can't take the next 10 people on the queue, all of whom have treatable conditions that could be handled at far lower cost. So I've always been a fierce opponent of EMTALA, and it's not because I like to see people die, and it's not because I hate poor people. It's because I think that voluntarism brings resources into a system which allows you to flourish, whereas all this government coercion drains resources from the system and essentially leaves everybody more impoverished than they would otherwise be. And the lesson that one would want to say about this is that we've seen EMTALA fail, and we're going to see Obamacare fail if, in fact, we find some way to reinstate these kinds of provisions. Already, we know that to the extent that you're willing to give people giant subsidies when they sign up for these programs, people will game the system. They will stay out of the system and even pay this mandated fee, if it comes to that, until they get sick, at which point they'll sign up. Nobody can turn them away because the pre-existing conditions is not a condition for denying coverage or for raising rent. They'll get themselves their treatment, and then they'll promptly quit again. The moral hazard dimension is an essential feature of understanding how to put together an insurance plan. And if you act as though every individual citizen who speaks about the right to health care in public will be perfectly virtuous when they act privately, what you're going to do is to create massive distortions in the way in which the overall system starts to operate. So, I mean, one has to be, I think, extremely aware and sensitive of all these programs. And one of the reasons why it may well be that the Obamacare stuff will be struck down on this point is that if the judges start to think about the implications of running a system in which everybody is forced to take in everybody else at a loss, and you generalize it, you can drive an entire economic system into the ground. If you could require people to get health care for less than it costs them, you could require them to get food for less than it costs them, and so forth. And at the time you're done, you just have a series of lost transactions which are mandated by the state with the kind of general illusion that somewhere down the line we'll make it up by increased productivity, which will never happen as the tax rates and the regulatory structure gets ever more intense.
Now, do you expect this to be, the Virginia case, to be the strongest argument going forward? If you look around at the other cases in Florida and other states that may come up, to be the leading edge of the effort that will reach the Supreme Court?
When the Supreme Court takes this, what case comes first, what case comes second down below is of no consequence. This thing is going to be heard by the Supreme Court no matter what the configuration is. All of these cases are essentially dry runs with a set of arguments that are put forward, and the court will take one of them. They will consider what was said in every one of them. They will have a set of amicus briefs, which will be a pile high, a mile high, on each side of the line. And then they'll do exactly what they want on a de novo basis. So I don't think that any effort to sort of strategize this case in terms of the mandate issue is going to yield anything profitable. The best guess, as I said in that little column for Ricochet, is that it depends upon which way our good friend Justice Kennedy decides that he's going to let the tea leaves fall. I mean, it's kind of frightening to think that a system of judicial review can come down to that, but that's probably what the case is. But it's not the only issue that's there, and let me mention briefly the two others that are very much alive in this case. The first of this is the so-called question of state sovereignty or federal encroachment. One of the things that this bill does is it says that if any state wants to pull out of the Medicaid program, which the government seeks to expand, it's going to have to take care of a very large fraction of poor people as the price of getting out from underneath the federal mandate. And to some people, this is no better than the federal government saying, either we're going to shoot you or we're going to take all your money. If you're an independent sovereign, you cannot let the federal government dictate that you spend your particular money in this particular way instead of spending it, say, on education or criminal systems or whatever else you think turns out to be important. That article, that argument, survived an initial screening in the McCollum case down in Florida, and my guess is that it has some legs to it as well, if only because the state sovereignty doctrine was invoked at least in one or two cases in the 1990s. so that this is not a derelict doctrine. This is not even like the Commerce Clause, where you had to think of a whole new theory in order to get yourself into a kind of a litigation position. So that's one argument. My own favorite argument actually talks about one of the most technical and obscure parts of the bill, which the public knows very little about. It's called the so-called medical loss ratio. And this is basically their attempts at disguised price fixing in the system. What the standard sort of individual and small group healthcare plan charges by way of administrative cost is, of course, variable, and it's also rather high because these plans are very expensive to run, and nobody knows what the definition of an administrative cost is anyhow until you put it to the test. And what the federal planners thought was that, gee, these guys must be inefficient, so what we'll do is we'll cap these fees at something like about 60 or 70% of what people currently charge, and then we're going to force them, if they charge more by way of administrative fees, to rebate the excess to their customers. To give you an idea of how preposterous this is like saying in a competitive market, all landlords just make all sorts of money, so what we want to do is to have a really tough rent control system, and if a guy spends more on administrative expenses than we think allowable, we rebate something to the tenant. That is actually unconstitutional, even under the current law, which is not particularly property protective, because what the law tends to say in these cases is you must allow a landlord to recover costs plus a reasonable rate of return, even if all the appreciation in the property goes to the benefit of the tenant. Well, if you look at those kinds of precedents in this particular area, you could easily imagine a set of rebates being constructed so that these poor firms will not be able to make any kind of rate of return with respect to their investment when they have all these reasonable administrative costs that they incur in a competitive system. I think it's an extremely attractive case if you could set it up correctly by having some company that's driven out of business by a set of regulations like this. What makes it tricky is that the government doesn't want to face that case. So what it will do under these circumstances is what it has already done together with the mini-med plans, the plans that give rather skimpy coverage to very low-paid workers, which is a lot better than no coverage at all. What they do is they waive the requirements. So what you're going to do is have a question is, can they keep on waiving these requirements to make sure that the issue never gets before a court? Because if it does get before a court, my guess is that the government will start to lose on these things.
Or they'll waive them until after the 2012 presidential election.
No. I don't think that. I think, in effect, if they start waiving these things, they have real issues of parity. And we don't know how long they're going to waive them, to whom they're going to waive them. I wrote another column on Forbes some weeks ago, which I called Government by Waiver, indicating just how tragically inconsistent this is with any notion of the rule of law, when you can either keep a statute in effect or pull it back without having any clear principles as to why you're doing it. But the government does not want to have to face the case in which it bankrupts a firm through regulation by ordering rebates when no money is available for it, throwing people who are in these plans out onto the street or into some other government plan where the subsidies will be even larger. But what's happened essentially is, if you look at this, forget about the individual mandate. The structure that we have put together costs far more than anybody imagined to live a far less than anybody else has wanted. And the question is, can you postpone this thing long enough to allow the system to gain its sea legs? There are some people who think that they can organize it well enough, that business will adapt fast enough. I'm not at all sure that it's going to happen in that particular way. And my guess is that we will have to see some rather major re-engineering of our expectations under this program if it's not to consume us together. And what the Commerce Clause litigation does under this is it makes renegotiation of the basic compact under the Affordable Care Act a much more plausible kind of scenario than it was before. It becomes a lever by which you can reconsider the entire overburdened structure in some kind of a coherent fashion. If, in fact, this tax is struck down, or this mandate is struck down, there's a huge division of opinion about two questions. One is, what else goes with it? I mean, this was funding something. Are the things that were funded, to wit, the additional coverage coming through the exchanges in one form or another, are those things going to go as well? Are you going to have to get rid of the provision which says that you can't price discriminate between high and low-risk patients by taking into account pre-existing conditions? You've got all of these issues which essentially are sitting there in very dramatic form Which nobody knows how to answer. And the second question that you have to answer is the practical one. If this revenue source is taken away, you got to go back to Congress to get another one through the general taxing power. And nobody believes that you can get through the kinds of hefty taxes that you're going to need to do this through a Congress in which you have a Republican House and a somewhat more conservative Democratic Senate. So the whole thing has all sorts of very strange and very difficult sort of implication. And that's the way the world operates at this point. I mean, what's going to happen ultimately, nobody knows. But I think we can say that the prices of the aggressive introduction of legislation that hadn't sufficiently, as it were, been tested through public debate and deliberation, we now see the cost coming in at the back end.
And that is an excellent point and a very cogent analysis of where we're at and perhaps where we're likely to go. And I guess the down payment is, if you're a betting man, keep your money off of this case because it all depends on where
Justice
Kennedy...
Well, as I said in one of those things, I said, this is going to go deep into the... This is a 15-round fight, and there's not going to be a TKO by the government in the third round.
Terrific. Richard, thank you very much for your commentary.
My pleasure.